It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. More than 40 million Americans care for an elderly or disabled loved one. Today, a new study by the AARP estimates the value of their work at $450 billion per year. That is a good deal for society, but it can be hard on the family members doing the work. The study finds they need a lot more help. Here's NPR's Jennifer Ludden.
Simondo Henley's mother was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis as he was starting college. She's now wheelchair-bound, and Henley, 36, has been taking care of her for nearly two decades.
A little bit more, some little bit more. Right there is good.
He rubs a prescription cream under her right knee. It helps with severe hot flashes and loosens her joints.
You know, I've had to give her injections before and that kind of stuff. This is much easier.
Henley does have help. Montgomery County, Maryland, where they live, and the MS Society pay for 35 hours of home health aides each week, though that's threatened by budget cuts. But every day, Henley must help his mom in and out of bed, onto the toilet. He even rolls her over in the middle of the night if she becomes uncomfortable. Care like this from a professional can cost tens of thousands a year. But Henley does it for free, of course, and on top of his full-time job. The AARP study finds family members spend an average 20 hours a week providing care. Henley refuses to count, but his mom, Vicky, keeps tab.
Simondo's care for me was about 40 hours a week.
That's like another full-time job.
Yes.
Modern medicine now allows people to manage chronic conditions for decades, but the AARP study finds increasingly complicated procedures are routinely expected of family caregivers. Henley remembers the time his mom was being discharged from the hospital. She had a catheter in, and the nurse said, "Oh, we'll call you and tell you how to take it out over the phone."
And I said, "Oh, no, you will not." I'm like, really? This is my mother.
The burden on families is huge.
Lynn Feinberg co-authored the AARP study. She says modern family caregiving is incredibly stressful.
While families are stepping up to the plate and provide this contribution to society, the costs to their own health and financial security is huge.
The study finds those who cut back work lose hundreds of thousands of dollars in income over a lifetime. Feinberg says caregivers are also more prone to depression, to physical ailments, and social isolation.
They will burn out, they will get sick, and there will be no other option but to place someone in a nursing home, which is what nobody wants.
And if the burden for caregivers seems big now, Suzanne Mintz of the National Family Caregivers Association says it's only going to get worse as the baby boom generation enters old age.
Boomers have fewer kids than their parents did, and they're working, and they don't necessarily live around the corner anymore.
On top of this, there's a shortage of paid home health aides. Last week, the Obama administration joined labor groups calling for the creation of 2 million more jobs in home health care, plus a new visa for immigrants willing to enter the field. Suzanne Mintz has grappled with the problem in caring for her husband, who has MS. Earlier this year, she had trouble finding someone to change his catheter twice a week while she was at work, so she says she resorted to something a little crazy.
With Stephen's permission, I actually put a note on the neighborhood listserv.
A little different than watering the flowers?
Yeah, right.
Sure enough, a man who works from home said he'd be willing to try it. He's been doing it ever since, for free. Mintz says we need to expand our definition of family. Next year, she plans to launch a recruitment drive to match those in need with volunteers.
It might be, I can drive her to PT for the next 5 Thursdays. Or I can bring meals for the next 6 months.
In other words, create a community of caregivers, an old idea, really, for a new age. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This week, several hundred American business leaders urged Congress and the president to do their job, raise the debt ceiling. Their letter is signed by CEOs of big businesses and small businesses, companies that produce goods and companies that provide services. Yesterday, we heard from the CEO of one of the smaller companies on that list, an Idaho box manufacturer that employs 45 workers. Today, the CEO of a substantially larger firm, the Pella Corporation, Pella Windows and Doors. It's based in Pella, Iowa. It employs over 8,000 people, and the CEO is Patrick Meyer. Hiya.
Hello, Robert.
And first, why did you sign the letter?
Well, Pella Corporation is a strong U.S. manufacturer with an 86-year history of creating good, stable manufacturing jobs. And we have 12 U.S. plants and employ, over 8,000 employees. And we're part of an industry that really is struggling to recover from a very deep and long recession. And so that translates into consumer and business confidence that's still weak. And any risk to that confidence will have a negative impact on our industry.
Is it fair to say that as construction goes, so goes Pella?
It does. And, we're in two big business segments on the commercial side and on the residential side, and both on the new construction side as repair and remodeling. And so each has a different ebb and flow. One of the things that's actually positive for us right now is our commercial business, and it acts differently than the residential business.
Now, I believe the favorable tax treatment for getting cleaner, greener windows expired, didn't it? Did the demand fall off at that point, or does it continue just as strong even without the tax benefit?
No, you're right, Robert. In last year, there was a stimulus to replace your windows on the residential side. And that created a tremendous impact to our business. A lot of consumers responded to that. That really drove up our business to the end of last year. And you're right, it was terminated at the end of 2010. And we did see demand drop off. The consumers did pull back. And so 2011, the market has pulled back quite a bit.
Now, people are always talking about what it's going to take for our companies, our manufacturers like Pella, to hire more people and to expand. And people talk about cutting your taxes, cutting your regulations, or just getting more demand for your product out there in the marketplace. As you look ahead, what are your priorities? What would help you most of those possibilities?
Well, I think it really centers around confidence. Over the last several years, the homeowners on the residential side have really deleveraged. And so their confidence in their ability to have their home be valued well, to invest back in that, is very important for us. We see that as an opportunity that's really important, that the consumer has to have confidence that when they invest in their home, they're going to get a good return on that.
It is said, the Washington Post reported in a story about the letter that was sent to Congress and the president, that no mention was made of taxes in it because they couldn't achieve unanimity on whether the letter should say don't include any tax increase at all or get realistic and include some tax increases. What do you think about that?
I think it's got to be around taking out waste mm-hmm. and reducing cost. There's times that we can raise price or raise taxes. I don't think this is the time. I think the time is to focus on taking the waste out of the system, looking at this holistically, and continue that focus.
Let me ask you something, which I guess this comes from decades of living in Washington now, which is that when we speak with people about what they'd like Washington to do, it's very often quite neat and clean and all's for the general good. But the very same people will then retain a lobbying firm whose job is to go to the Hill and to the federal agencies and make sure that they get the best possible treatment they can possibly get, whether it's in an environmental program or a tax break. And all the people who are saying, just be straight and do your job, are also saying, and I'm paying a guy a zillion dollars to make sure that I get it played my way. What do you think?
Well, I think I'd say we'd always want to play a level playing field. To your point, we need it to be understandable, fair, and predictable. And then we can set up a business and plan for that. I do think that there is a strong sense of lobbyists in Washington. But what we need to count on, again, is just make it fair, and understandable, and predictable.
Well, Mr. Meyer, thank you very much for talking with us today.
All right, Robert.
Thank you. Patrick Meyer, who is the CEO of Pella Windows and Doors. He spoke to us from their headquarters in Pella, Iowa.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. It's been a tough couple of years for people who've been looking for summer jobs, but even the most desperate college student might pass up this situation. Door-to-door book sales, 13 hours a day, 6 days a week, and no guaranteed paycheck. But it is a summer job that some now famous people have endured, including politicians and a big-name prosecutor. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer has this story about the Southwestern Company.
Pedro Vega loves his job, or at least he tries to convince himself he does. Driving down a winding Tennessee road, this recent Texas A&M grad pumps himself up for the next stop. Post-it notes of Southwestern slogans and famous quotes are scattered on the dashboard. One says, "Successful people form a habit of what unsuccessful people aren't willing to do. How about working through lunch?" Today, it's bologna and white bread. Still chewing, Vega pulls in a driveway. He hops out of the car and sprints to the front door with his bag of book samples. Then he says a little prayer.
Day by day, 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 and everywhere by the grace of God, Lord, I'm getting better and better, getting better and better.
Southwestern's door-to-door sales started out with Bibles. That was shortly after the Civil War. Former Confederate soldiers hiked from one plantation to the next, trying to make money for college. The company left religion for homework help books. Now moms like Kathy Barrett get a pitch about investing in their child's education. And then comes the price.
Oh, I completely agree with the whole investment part. But if you're asking me, can I hand you $460 a day? No.
The job is a 10-week lesson in rejection. Sellers do well to get two yeses a day, which is why they're instructed to sit down with at least 30 families between sunup and sundown. Talk to enough people, someone will buy.
The solution to every problem is behind the next door.
The Southwestern sales force trains in Nashville for 1 week at the start of the summer. Before scattering around the U.S., they learn self-motivation techniques. They also role-play, negotiating with customers who say they don't have the money.
You know, I won't cash the check until next month, if that works better with you, Ms. Jones.
Anna Lee from Vancouver, Canada, is just one of this year's 2,500 salespeople. Many were recruited from their college campuses after hearing who else spent their summers this way: Texas Governor Rick Perry, Ken Starr, who investigated President Bill Clinton, and Christian author Max Lucado. Dan Moore did his time. He's now the CEO who gives the final send-off, which is a warning.
Just before you knock, a truck will come out of the driveway, and there's a bunch of people your age, guys and girls, and they've got towels, and they've got their bathing suits on, and they're laughing and listening to music, and they're going to go off to the lake and have a really good time.
Don't go, Moore says. Any activity unrelated to sales is strongly discouraged, even calling home during the work week. That's what Sundays are for.
A person makes money according to the results they get.
Moore says students essentially run their own business, which means they bear all of the risk.
We are a wholesaler, so the money they make is the difference between what they sell it for and what they are charged for it.
3 in 10 don't make it past the first few weeks, and they often leave with hard feelings. Some share stories at southwesterncompanytruth.com, calling the company everything from a cult to a scam. Students can lose money in the venture, and of course, some just can't take the heat and the dogs. With a yapper at his heels, Pedro Vega says it doesn't bother him. The potential for a big payout does make the hazards more manageable. Vega took home $22,000 as a rookie and now makes more with salespeople working under him. Beyond money, he says the job has made him an emotional giant.
I'm not like most people. Most people are miserable and they're sad, they're depressed, and I don't care. So I'm going to be one of the coolest people Ms. Jones is going to meet probably in the entire summer, but I'm definitely going to be the coolest person to meet today.
And there are still more Mrs. Joneses to see with a few weeks left in the Southwestern selling season. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. 18 days, that's the time between now and a possibly calamitous default on the national debt. That leaves little time for Congress to devise and pass a plan to raise the debt ceiling. 6 days of talks at the White House have failed to produce a deal. And as NPR's David Wellner reports, there were no talks today, but plenty of talking.
At his White House news conference, President Obama referred to an unprecedented default on the debt as Armageddon. "We should not even be this close to a deadline on this issue," he said, and added, "this should have been taken care of earlier."
We are obviously running out of time. And so what I've said to the members of Congress is that you need over the next 24 to 36 hours to give me some sense of what your plan is to get the debt ceiling raised through whatever mechanisms they can think about, and show me a plan in terms of what you're doing for deficit and debt reduction.
If the president cast himself today as the man waiting for a plan, House Speaker John Boehner struck a similar pose at a news conference here at the Capitol. If there's no plan at this late hour, he suggested, don't blame Republicans.
Time and again, Republicans have offered serious proposals to cut spending and address these issues. And I think it's time for the Democrats to get serious as well.
And one Democrat in particular, Boehner said, needs to get serious.
We asked the president to lead. We asked him to put forward a plan, not a speech, a real plan. And he hasn't. We will.
The plan Boehner and House Republicans are putting forward is legislation called Cut, Cap, and Balance. They plan to vote on it next week. It slashes spending, puts a tightening cap on the federal budget, and makes a higher debt ceiling contingent on a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. It would also require a two-thirds supermajority for raising taxes. Democrats say that plan would be dead on arrival in the Senate. President Obama today called it just making a political statement.
We don't need a balanced budget amendment. We simply need to make these tough choices and be willing to take on our basis.
The president cited his own willingness to rankle fellow Democrats by looking to cut costs in Medicare and Social Security. Republicans, he said, should be willing to do what national polls say most Americans, even most Republicans, think reasonable. Reducing deficits should be done by cutting spending and by raising taxes on the well-off as well. But Majority Leader Eric Cantor declared on the House floor that Republicans won't agree to raising taxes.
That's why that construct doesn't work. We don't have the votes on this side of the aisle. I'm not supportive of raising taxes on people who are trying to make it right now and can't.
And that's the core of the debt ceiling impasse. Cantor and other Republicans refuse to budge on taxes, while President Obama says he won't sign a deficit reduction package without tax hikes on the wealthy. That's why many lawmakers think a fallback scheme introduced this week by Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell will ultimately prevail. It shifts all the political responsibility for raising the debt limit to President Obama, while making no commitment to deficit reduction. But after having praised that plan yesterday, Speaker Boehner was more cautious about it today after meeting with fellow House Republicans.
Listen, Senator McConnell pointed out that his plan was being put on the table as a last-ditch effort. We're far from the time for a last-ditch effort.
But it may be Boehner who is far from convincing his own Republicans in the House to go along with McConnell's fallback plan. Making that plan politically more attractive appears to be this weekend's homework assignment for negotiators in both parties. David Wellen, NPR News, The Capitol.